which one's different.
Okay, so. So what do I think Coyotes got right and wrong? Always a dicey proposition, right? Because as the designer, I obviously have a completely unbiased view of my ancestry. I think that the notion of invoking protected descriptors, if you're going to do a messaging system, I think that the naming mechanism needs to be protected. Because there are messaging systems where the way it works is, you know, every process has an associated number, which is the process ID. And the way I send you a message is, I go to the kernel and say, send this message to process 5. Whatever process is in slot 5 of the process table, gets it. Or whatever process has that process ID. Now, the problem with that is that there is no way for a process to go like that. There's no way to say, I don't want to get messages from you. Because the corollary to that is, if you're out to make me do extra work, there's no way for me to stop you, right? You can spend all day throwing messages at me, and I gotta do work to throw them away. There's the direct problem. It's also the fact that in that scheme, any information can go anywhere, right? There's no control over the flow of information in the system. And that's something you want to be able to have. And not only because you're a security nut, but also just because you want reliability. Reliability is at least partly an information flow problem, because the information flow tells you where the error can propagate to, or more precisely, where the consequences of the error can propagate to. And if you know that, you might have a place to stand to design recovery. But if you don't know that, I promise you, you don't. So I think this idea of using protected descriptors as the foundational naming mechanism is a good thing. I'm not convinced that we got the interface to it right, but I think that the notion that mapping metadata, the GPTs, should be first class is a good thing. But let me explain here, we've got to be a little careful what we mean by first class, because there are pros and cons to GPTs. One of the downsides of GPTs is, hey, you know, if I have a large contiguous virtual region and I can manage to get it mapped to a large contiguous physical region, I can describe that with a base and amount and permission. I don't need a big data structure to do that. And the GPT can't capture that. There is some loss of efficiency. Not entirely convinced that GPTs have to be individually nameable. I can imagine a design in which we had an address space abstraction. There were operations for mapping things, and the intermediate data structures were something that the kernel would be able to optimize if it had cause to. The piece that's important is that the storage that holds that state is getting charged to the process. The problem is that because of issues with congruency boundaries, there is no simple relationship between the number of pages you have mapped and the size of the data structure. I need to describe those mappings in a general data structure. I mean, there are designs we could use where we can answer that question, but none of those designs have efficient properties and access. Reason tree structures are convenient. But if you go to tree structures, those lead to congruency issues. So that you pay for what you get, I think, is a very powerful idea, or useful idea. But the cost of it is, I have to be ready to deal with the fact that you might no longer pay for what you got. That's the recovery problem I was just talking about. And that's nasty. One of the things that I think Unix gets deeply wrong, like there's a discussion going on now on the AppArmor development list about how to essentially retrofit a fix, is the amount of ambient authority. It's authority that your process can use because it somehow exists in the process environment, not to be confused with authority your process uses because it said specifically it wanted to use that piece of its authority. One of the reasons that there's so many bugs with setuid programs isn't any clean way for the program to express when it wants to use the setuid authority and when it doesn't. And it's very, very hard to manage that stuff. Finally, in this one one of the things I think Unix gets right, and in some respects, I'd like to move in this direction in Coyotes, but I haven't been able to figure out how. In first order, all Unix objects are strings. I hold the descriptor, I can do reads and writes. There's a basic set of operations that all descriptors honor. And that's extremely helpful. One of the things that's not clear. Maybe that, one interpretation is, well, having a common object protocol or a common communication protocol is useful, so everybody should implement a common protocol. And that's the plan 9 direction. Another view you can take. Look, the reason the stream model looks so clean in Unix is that there's a large set of objects that it didn't try to build descriptors for. So those objects don't have any observable protocol in the architecture, and so it doesn't jump out at you that if they had an observable protocol, the stream model really wouldn't be a good fit. Like processes. If a process was named by a descriptor, what would it mean to do reads and writes to it? One way to sort of get a view of that, well, gosh, there are actually Unix systems in which processes do have descriptors. System 5 and its derivatives, not counting Linux, have something called slash proc. Linux has something of the same name but isn't. And in slash proc, I can open a descriptor, and I can do various operations on the descriptor to access the state of the process, and state here of the process is interpreted broadly. I can read and write the target address space of the process. Yet, if you dig into that interface, what you'll discover is it's a kludge. Seek, read, write interface is to an address space, but it's a very peculiar address space because parts of it are not backed. It's not a file. It holds. If you look at the interface for doing process control operations, you'll discover that it got shoehorned into the IO control mechanism, which is basically the garbage pit of the Unix interface, as I said. It's not obvious what reads and writes there would mean. Now, the Plan 9 implementation takes a different view. They say, well, slash proc slash 5 is not a file that you open, it's a directory. And inside that directory, there are subfiles. There's one subfile for each of the things we might want to do, and where you would have done an IO cuddle get registers. In the Plan 9 design, you open the register subfile, and you either read them or write them. And then Plan 9 goes further and says, by the way, all of these things are done with ASCII. Thing that your kernel really wants to know how to build. I don't buy the ASCII story. But notice that this sounds nice, and it has many advantages, right? It's very easily remotable. That's a good thing, right? It's regular. It's simplifying. All that's good. And it does provide a common interface, which is a nice thing. And the fact that there are process IDs and there are system calls that take IDs instead of descriptors is just an error in the design. Yeah. If you think a little harder about what's going on in Plan 9, you'll quickly conclude that there are pieces of that interface that even if the data structure is represented as ASCII, what you're reading is a record. It's not a string. If I open up proc 5 registers, or whatever it's called in Plan 9, obviously if I do a read that's big enough, I kind of know what that means. If I do a read that's short, I kind of know what that means. But if I then do another read, where if I open the registers file, I seek to offset 5 and then do a read. Now, what the hell does that mean? And it's also not a stream in a different sense. You're reading something that is a moving target. You'd like it to be well-defined whether the answer you get is self-consistent. So one advantage of the old interface, you do the get registers IO control, right? The specification requires, at least on an instantaneous basis, the process is stopped. The registers are copied. If appropriate, the process is resumed. But the register that you get, the register set that you get, is a consistent cut. It's a long fight. It's hard to figure out how to express that in a streamish interface. Imagine my register type is 150 bytes. I read 50. I go off and do something. I come back and read 100. Should those be 100 stale bytes from whatever the register set was that internally we took a snapshot of? Or should they be in the register set now? And this is just what's happening here is not that there's anything wrong with the stream interface. It's that we're pushing the definition of what it means to be a stream, and we're trying to reconcile different models of data consistency on this interface. And part of the reason that the Plan 9 stuff works is that nobody asked these kinds of hard questions. And by the way, they could have resolved them all. Hotpipes is a very smart design. Other people who were involved in Plan 9, very, very clever people. Right? But these are the kinds of things that research group wasn't interested in sort of pushing to the edge. So I'm torn about everything's a stream. There are advantages and disadvantages. The other way to look at it is, well, it's supposed to take the view, no, everything's an object, and it has a method interface, which is basically what Microsoft has done with, this week, is it still called ActiveX this week? Now the problem is I want to talk to an object I've never seen before. How do I bootstrap an understanding of its protocol? The reason that Microsoft scripting languages work is that the Olay, what was originally the Olay layer, included some sort of well-known protocols by which you could basically go to the object and query it to find out what its interface was, and then you could dynamically call it. And the reason that worked is that VB is a dynamic language. That's it? Well, I agree that it's a mess, and part of that is, believe it or not, they actually didn't understand it all on the first day. It went through some evolution. That's just the way life works, and that's not really a fair criticism. But, you know, bottom line, this stuff mostly works. And it's the first time anybody's built an extensible object system that did, and that's actually a pretty remarkable thing. And I'm not a, you know, obviously I'm not a huge Microsoft fan, but I think credit where it's due, and they did a really good job with that stuff. The part that doesn't work is the versioning interface. And that's because nobody knows in principle how to do it. It's not because the Microsoft clients, they're not. Okay, so that one I could go back and forth on. In Kyoto's, the resolution was it was too big a risk to change. File system is troubling to me. It is extremely helpful to be able to name things and to be able to build an interface that looks more like a POSIX-ish, stream-ish interface. Closely tied. If you're going to take the view that everything is a stream, then you have to take the view that objects, instead of publishing methods, can publish what amounts to directories. That happens in Plan 9. One way to think about the kernel process from the file system, from the proc file system perspective, is there's a piece of kernel code, right, that is an object implementation, right, and it implements an impedance matcher between a interface. Actually, it's it runs their 9P protocol, and that thing knows how to do mount. So basically, I can open up a directory. It knows how to enumerate all of the control points of the process, the subfiles. It knows how to open one of those subfiles. It knows how to answer, read, and write. And there's an object back there that's implementing those protocols. What's really going on is that object is implementing an IDL-style method interface. It's been shoehorned or layered, depending on your point of view, on top of this stream interface, and the way it's resolving the fact that it's not an object model is by multiplying streams to make it an object model. And the Plan 9 guys were very direct. They said, look, the good thing about streams is we know how to promote them. They're very general. It's possible to write very simple programs that manipulate them, also utility kinds of programs. Right? You want another register set? Fine. Use cat. There's a lot of merit to that, but the mechanism isn't free. The problem that I have with capabilities in the absence of namespaces is that from a human perspective, object IDs just aren't very meaningful names. You and I need to be able to put things in namespaces and refer to them, and we need to be able to have common conventions, and I need to be able to hand you a namespace and say, here's a set of stuff that we're working on together. I also would like to be able to share a notion of naming with some program number, like Word. I'm able to say, well, I have this file, you know, admumble.doc, and I'd like you to open it. Now here we get into trouble, because the problem, notice that the problem was not the existence of a naming hierarchy. The problem was the existence of a naming hierarchy in which multiple parties had write permission. Worse, in which a program I didn't trust had all of my authority. If we could do a one-off namespace or mediated namespace, Word, I'd actually be able to rescue a lot of the POSIX interface. Say what you will about POSIX. There's a large body of code that uses it. If you could reuse that code without taking your pants down and inviting somebody to stick something up your posterior, that would be a nice thing to be able to do. Thanks, guys. I've yet to figure out how to do that. Congratulations as to whether they enjoy the experience. Okay. So this namespace thing, Brock is over there. Like, I don't believe he said that. It's my last day. So the namespace thing, I'm very much on the fence about. From a human perspective, I like it. One can build namespaces on a capability system, right? And you set up an object, it implements a directory, boom, you got a namespace, right? You could imagine right now, you know enough, take you a couple of tries, but you could write the IDL file for a directory descriptor. Not hard to do. Or you could cheat, you could go look at the Eros tree where we have one. Directories are a little tricky, though, because what you want to give me, in some sense, is access to a directory where I can read the directory and maybe I can open up the objects, but somewhere at the bottom, you want to be able to say, well, but I want some constraints in those objects. I want you to be able to walk a path through a directory and then get to a bottom level thing, and I want your rights on it to be different from my rights on it. I want to be able to write it, you want to be able to read it. But the minute we stick a descriptor into the directory, we have to choose which descriptor we're going to stick in, and the permissions on the descriptor are what they are. That's a little tougher. At that point, we need a mediator, and that mediator is not necessarily an easy thing to think through. Particularly not when we're not in the model of everything's a stream. And one nice thing about everything's a stream is, if you fail the write call, then no write's going to happen. Is that true? I have an interface that consists of open, read, write, close. And I write a shim layer that disables the write system call. Do I have prevented writes? Do I hit? The answers are either yes or no. Why don't we assume for a minute that open is safe? Let's further assume that close destroys my descriptor. We somehow know that the fact that I didn't close may get transmitted. That's not really new information. The fact that I had done an open already meant that eventually I was going to do a close. So things that basically you transmit one bit of information and then there's no more are just not very important here. Now I'm left with read and write. I've suppressed write. suppressed the write operation. Have I prevented write? Just to repeat that, there is something back there that's actually implementing the recall. It can interpret that any way it wants. And it could choose to interpret read to mean change of state. So how might I build that? How would I go about that? I think I could do better than that. Let's assume I cannot re-enable write to live. Well, I mean, I want to take out the obvious abuses. Read is a two-way interface. Because there's a length that goes across, and either through read or through sync, there's a position that goes across. So every read operation, depending on your implementation, conveys either 4 bytes or 8 bytes, or if you want to do a big file system, 8 bytes or 16 bytes, to the implementer. So we're just arguing about the rate of transmission. Why is it that in Unix, cutting off the write interface is good enough? Again, ignoring the close open, IO cuddle, patch control, your nearest and dearest and friend. Why is turning off write good enough in Unix? I don't get to provide the thing, the operation. I think that's another way of saying anything that implements read is trusted code. Say. Okay, well then what did you mean? That was my next point. Right. So it's tempting to imagine that that's true because you certainly can look at the Linux system and say, yeah, well, okay, I know the file system, I know the pipe, proc is broken, but I know what it does. Sockets, yeah, they're implemented by the kernel. When you go down the laundry list, you know, all these things are implemented by the kernel. Maybe you've heard of something called iSCSI, NFS. And NFS, by the way, stands for four-letter words that I will not disclose publicly. Not flipping stable. My personal favorite, NFS stands for not a file system. Because it does not actually implement file system semantics when you dig into the fine print. It gets close enough to work, you know, enough of the time that you don't complain to development very often. Which is good enough, right? As Earl Bobert says, crap in a hurry. Is what makes a success in the software business. So the problem with this is, it's implemented by somebody's kernel, or it's implemented by somebody's server that happens to speak the NFS protocol and can't convince me to mount it. If it's implemented by your kernel, well, okay, that's nice, but I have no basis for thinking your kernel's kosher. Never did, but you know, with open source, it's no longer even imaginable. Right, obviously you could change it. In fact, you always could. It's just that now you can't really argue about it, right? So in fact, what I have is an ill-founded trust assumption. Now, I can configure Linux systems in which all those things are provided by trusted code. I can turn off trust. I can let programs speak over sockets but not agree to mount them, right? And so by construction, by constraint, I can make sure that read is good enough. You can't do that in a general object system because you don't know who's providing the read. That's part of why the confinement story is important. Well, let me be careful. You can only do that in a general object system if you can enumerate all the parties who are providing the read. I'm using a trusted implementation. Exactly how it's done in the Linux story. Okay. So it's tempting to think that the stream interface bought you something. Notice, by the way, just to close out that point, notice that Plan 9 broke that part because any process in Plan 9 can implement 9P And if I hold the descriptor, and if the thing on the other end implements 9P, and I say mount, damn it, it's mounted. I mean, it's only mounted in my address space, which helps. Right? So maybe the story is, well, look, you have sufficient authority to hang yourself. Religious arguments aside, you know, that's not a bad position. Except that then you're going to run software that cares, right? So, great, I have a private address space, right? And I say, mount my own provider on top of the Etsy password. And then I run something, you know, really obnoxious, like I format the main partition of the system, right? Which I'm trying to do first. Like, well, you know, give me root authority. Right? So like SU. SU says, oh, okay, give me the root password. I type something. SU says, good, I have, you know, something that you claim is the root password, and I'm going to check it. So what do I do? I'm going to open Etsy password. Oh, but you just mounted something on top of Etsy password. So the answer it's going to get from Etsy password is whatever you want it to hear. Now, there's a very elegant security architecture in Plan 9 that dodges this bullet. But it wasn't in the original design. It actually was a response to this kind of problem. It's a very nice design. But you have to think it out when you start letting people play with the namespace, because there are places in the namespace that people rely on to be trustworthy. And in Plan 9, because the namespace can be fiddled, the binding of a name cannot be a basis for security. Persistence. The current implementation of Kyotos doesn't implement persistence, so at least for the moment, this is moot. That'll come soon. Most of persistence in terms of architectural complexity is surprisingly high. More precisely, okay, here's the way to think about it. If we didn't have to do general persistence, if all we had to do was paging, then capabilities could just be pointers, and we would be limited by the size of the kernel virtual space, but we could page much of that virtual space in and out. And big things in and out would not require us to alter any of the pointer values. Page the kernel just like we page an application. And as long as we don't have to alter the pointer values, we don't need any of the back pointers from objects or capabilities. Two things that induce that requirement. The persistence, the destroy operation. The destroy operation, you can even dodge the bullet there if you had a short enough list of options. What I want to do for the last project, as I said, I'm not going to wrap, well, this is going to ratchet up the complexity in the sense that there are a few more processes in the picture, but I don't think what they're doing is particularly complex. Some of you just woke up. I want to do the exercise that illustrates why a persistent capability system does not require anything like setUID. So I will write this up and I will send that email. Okay, but here's the notion. The piece that I'm going to have to ask you, to suspend disbelief on. And the reason you have to suspend disbelief is we don't actually currently have persistence. So what I'm going to ask you to do is implement a structure that we can't actually exploit right now. Until we have that. I should implement first a process that implements the password protocol. Okay, so this process owns the password database and it implements set, check, add, and remove. Entries in the password database are triples of the form username password capability. And for the moment, are the capability parts, just the username and password. You'll have an MKI file that implements this process. This should be a boot process, not a constructed. More precisely, actually what it should be, and I will get instructions on how to do this, there actually should be a constructor for this, but this process actually needs to be in the primordial system. It just needs to look like it was built for identification purposes. I will send you instructions on that part, but the point is, conceptually, if the system is running, this process already exists. And I should implement a program on the one hand that can change passwords, and the other, a pseudo login. So let me explain. The issue here is we don't yet have a way to tie standard input. So I'm not asking you to actually give interaction with the user to change the password. Imagine that you're at the point where you've already gotten the alleged password from the user, and you're going to call the password database to compare the old password, which you have by just building it in, and set the new password. Similarly, for login, imagine you just compile the password into the program, so you know a priori what it is. And for your password database, we build a database. But these things come from constructors. So the idea is that I should have a program, my program. I should go to the password constructor, or rather the password change constructor, and say, make me a copy of the password changing program. And then invoke that program to change the password. Here's the interesting part. Remember the mechanism for setting up tools for a constructed object? Build your MKI file for the password changer program. One of the tools will be an entry capability to the password database program that is already running in the primordial system. Note that this violates confinement. The constructor will build unconfined programs. It's happy to do that. It is willing to tell you whether the real result will be unconfined. If you were to say to the password change constructor, is your result confined? The answer would be no, because it has access to this shared modifiable program. So that entry capability to the password database will be one of the tools held by the password change program. Similarly, it'll be one of the tools held by the pseudo-logging program. So what I actually want is not for the data for the change actually shouldn't be precompiled in the pseudo-login, and it shouldn't be precompiled in the password change. It should be precompiled into your test harness. And here's the point. Actually, you know what? If the password change program can do both a get and an update, right? So the get says, here's a username, here's what I think the password is, tell me yes or no. The update is, here's a username, here's what I think the current password is, here's what the new password should be. Then we don't actually need to put it in sudo login. Now, here's the point of all of this. What we will have built here is an agent that is the password change agent. Agent has the authority to edit the password database on your behalf, even though you do not. You have the authority to instantiate one of these agents. Why should you instantiate it? Because you want to make sure you're not running from my copy, because who knows if my copy scrubbed its memory. Contrast this just in your head for a minute with the Unix design, right? The way you solve this in Unix, because it is not possible for SBIN password, the program, to have by prior arrangement a durable connection to the password database, it's required that SBIN program has to use open. And if SBIN password uses open, it has to have a way to open a file that you can't. And since you're the one who fired off SBIN password, it has to get that authority by magic. Magic in Unix is called setUID. And the point of this exercise is to satisfy yourself that that magic is not necessary. Now, of course, the problem with this story is if we yank the plug, we're going to lose the password database, which is not really the solution we were looking for. But when persistence comes in, this whole structure will be durable for the long term. So I hope that at least conceptually that's not an overwhelming burden. It'll illustrate a useful point about how you can use these kinds of natural security solutions that in non-persistent systems, are magic. Last thing that I think Coyotes and Arrows get right, I don't want to forever, and frankly, some of it's minor detail that's not hugely important. There is no formal model for Unix. And if there were, realistically, we wouldn't try to prove the correctness of the Unix system. It's too bloody complicated. We've done some work towards verifying interesting chunks of literature. Not say that we have verified it yet. We've done some property checking on it. But we do have a formal model, and we have strong reason to believe it's right. And that model has turned out to be surprisingly powerful, even though we can't automate a verification of the source code. We can look at the source code, walk through what it does, compare it to what the model says is and is not okay, and there may remain an implementation bug in the source code, but there's more than one. But in abstract, we can look at the code and know that if we were to really push to get the implementation bugs out and apply tools that would help us to do that, in principle, we know what a correct implementation might be. Nobody knows what that is for Unix. When the time comes to look at optimizations, it's possible to have a model in the back of our head that says, okay, we have some constraints. They come to us from the model. We know that if we violate those constraints, things are wrong. And conversely, we know that if we don't violate those constraints, we have not violated any of the foundational security properties of the system. and the resulting optimization might be a dumb idea, but it's still safe, assuming we implement it correctly. That's a big assumption, but that's not as big as I don't know what the hell it's supposed to do. You know, when I started that work in the mid-1990s, I have to say it was driven by something that I'm kind of embarrassed about. History was, I started Eros not as a PhD project, but to reverse engineer a system that I thought was really well done, in much the same way that Linus sat down to reverse engineer Unix, at much the same time. In fact, I started a little earlier. I copied somebody else's system does not a PhD make, no matter how cleverly. So, and shouldn't. What I found myself forced to do was to assemble a story and essentially made that work retroactively justified. And one way to do that was to say, look, the argument of the PhD should not be, here's a cool system, but rather it should be, here's a cool system and we know why. Here are what the properties of the system are, and here's how we know, or why we have reason for confidence. And another question that was open in the literature at that time, there was some evidence, mixed evidence, but some fairly strong evidence, that nobody knew how to do a fast capability system. I think it's fair to say that the one that I built was the first general purpose fast capability. And fast meant that it was cycle for cycle competitive with the then fastest microkernels in the world. One of the open questions, look, you know, you might say, well, if I'm gonna go do a cross-process call, and I gotta go through this descriptor thing, and I gotta check if the descriptor is valid, you imagine at least there's an extra cost for the check. If there's no other extra cost in that picture, there's an extra cost for the check. So the hypothesis was, and this hypothesis was plausible from lots of evidence from lots of places, there ought to be a cost to protection. The question is, well, what is that cost? The answer at the end of that work was, we can't find it. And not only can't we find it, but the people who don't have it can't generate better results than we do. Now, that doesn't mean it's not there, but it means if it's there, it's down in the noise. And when I say people who were on competing systems couldn't find it, I mean specifically Jochen Liebke and Hermann Hartig and others in their groups, and later a team down in Australia. And just to sort of give you a sense of who these guys were, some of these guys were people who had spent so much time working on this cross-process problem that they could tell you where every cycle was going for every model of Pentium that was then in the field, and why that specific implementation of that Pentium introduced that particular cycle at that particular instruction. And I'm sure there were four more cycles to get out of their work somewhere. But I couldn't find them, and they couldn't find them. At least not right then. And look, you know, at the end of the day, if we get this down to four cycles, the cost of protection is not a problem. The dissertation was, we're going to frame this as a general capability machine. We're going to give a formal model for how the machine operates. We're going to show that its foundational security property is actually formally correct. And then, oh, by the way, we're going to demonstrate that it doesn't cost anything to have a formally correct system. That you can get a PhD for. You could probably get two, but I didn't think of that at the time. My advice on that score is do one PhD as much. So it would be nice to say I was really interested in verifying this stuff, right? So I got off into this verification stuff because it seemed fun. The truth is I was just frustrated. And so I went down the hall to Sam Weber's office, who knew a lot about this, and said, you know, there's this really cool problem that somebody ought to solve. And Sam said, oh, that sounds like fun! Right, so there, one of the secrets, go sucker a faculty member into solving your problem. Amazing how often that works. I certainly did not anticipate when we started that work. So when we started that work, here's what I saw. I saw a graph analysis problem that was tractable. It's clear that if we forced it hard enough, we'd get a verification through. Scott can tell you it requires a very great deal of forcing to get that verification through an automated prover. The nice thing about doing these things by hand is you can take shortcuts that you can also take in the automated prover with enough years of effort. But it was clear we could get it to go through. And I think, Scott, if I'm misstating the case, please jump in and correct me. But you've hit places where you said, you know, I formulated the structure of the argument in a way that the prover can't wake it through. And you've hit places where you said, damn it, this isn't going through. But, and you've hit a couple places where you said, oh, I spec the problem wrong, I'm going to go back and respec it. I don't think you've hit any place so far where you've looked at it and said, I've reached the conclusion that this really, in principle, shouldn't be solvable. Is that fair? So we had the first system specification that we knew this we could do this kind of verification on. Frankly, that wasn't a bad thing to push on. Because nobody had done it. What I didn't appreciate, and this is sort of my argument for why this kind of system analysis work that we were doing in this verification is good work to do. It's not that at the end of the day, you're going to get out an automated proof. That would be nice to have. You know, they got to get the Turing Award for doing it. Turing Award is a sure sign that you've been working on the same problem for far too long. What I didn't anticipate was the sort of the level of precision of problem specification that would emerge from that effort and the level of pragmatic utility that we would get from having that precision. It's really hard to test a system when you don't know what it's supposed to do. If you just say it that way, it sounds perfectly obvious, perfectly mundane, and people go on, and they go on to the next classroom, or they bring pizza to class. But it really is valuable. Now, honestly, if when we had started, it had been clear that it was going to take the kind of work that Scott's putting in the automated effort, it would have been nuts to do it, put in that much time. And if I had known how much time it was going to take Scott, I wouldn't have suggested it as a graduate project, because that was an obsessively, it's only clear that it was an obscenity in hindsight, and I was enough to done that. Okay. So I think that was a success, and there are other systems now building on that. Sort of that groundwork led the team down in Australia under Gernot Heiser, led is too strong, certainly encouraged them to go pursue doing formal verification for a stripped-down version of L4, and there are people willing to pay for that work and use it in really sensitive applications or robustness critical applications. There were three or four efforts that sort of got spun off basically because we sat up and said, it can be done. Well, how hard it was. always good to tell a part of the truth that's in your interest. tell the rest if you're asked, but you may not have to volunteer. So I think that was good. And I think it's generated enough pragmatic value to have been worth it. And I think in hindsight, Scott's case is going to be more compelling because he had gone through all the gory details that he avoided. Not only that, but he'll have a model where if you need to go through and say, okay, now I framed the model this way, and actually I really sort of need to reframe the model in this slight other way, so here's an example. In the formal model that we did on paper, an object, what's the state of an object? First, there's nothing in the system, in the security part of the system, that should ever depend on the value of some byte of your application. So data has no effect on system semantics. A little curious, but it turns out to be right. So what's left is the capabilities, and so in that system, an object is modeled as a set of capabilities, and the capability is basically a rights, comma, object name. Of course, that's not how the real system works. In the real system, objects have a finite number of slots. So if we were the reason we went for the set model was, one, it allowed us to exploit a bunch of set theory that people sort of knew comfortable with, and two, it was a generalization. It got us out of worrying about how many slots there were. If you carefully model a system where you say an object is 16 slots, here's the open question, well, what if it were 17 slots? Would the answer still hold? And the answer is yes, stupid, it would still hold, right? It's one thing to know that, it's another thing to prove it. At some point, I think we're going to take the model that Scott's done, which is a set model, and we're going to change it to a model where an object is a set of mappings from naturals to capabilities, and that'll give us indexing. Now, structurally, this is not an interesting change to the verification. Indexing is really important. I said a few minutes ago that one of the problems with Unix is that when I invoke a system call, I don't actually state the authority, I don't name the authority that justifies my right to perform an operation. Well, then the question should follow, well, how would I go about naming it? And the answer is, well, I actually have to be able to somehow designate the authority. And one way to do that is to give the slot that it sits in. It's that. So what's a little curious about this model is enough to tell us that we can that confinement can be implemented. And it's enough to tell us what is the sanity check that confirms that something is confirmed. But it is not enough to tell us that a particular piece of code, the constructor, actually does implement it. Missing link is, right, there's a loop in the constructor that goes, for every slot in the tools page, run the relevant predicate. And when you run out of slots, you're done. The problem is, the model, because it doesn't have the index, can't capture the notion that the program tested slot 5. So it can't talk about the notion that the program tested all the slots and there aren't any more. We haven't quite got enough foundation to verify that security critical programs are correct. We're missing a critical piece of designation. The good news, and this is the really bright spot to me in the work that Scott's doing, is we're one damn natural number away from doing that. The missing link in security modeling and operating systems, right? How does this work? It's a graph. You do a graph evolution analysis about how writes propagate across the graph. And then the problem is you have some privileged program that does some controlling operation that you care about. Now what? Because this thing violates the rules. The answer is, oh, well, whatever it is that that program does, you build it into the operational semantics of your model of the system. So if there's a password program that can give me some funny authority, you take the operations implemented by the password program and you make them primitive in the model. So the programs that you consider in the model are the non-privileged programs. And this has led to a whole school of security analysis that's statically conservative. And statically conservative, look, being statically conservatively safe, it's a good thing. It's a very conservative thing. And it doesn't account for the programs that we would most like to be able to analyze, which are the ones that implement the security policy. I think it's really cool that if we have this model stabilized, we'll now be able to look at those programs and we'll now be able to talk about systems models where some of those programs are safe because we know what their program does. Right now, the notion is, I'm going to assume I don't know what program the process obeys, and so any operation can do it, will do, and now I'm going to argue that it doesn't matter what it can, what it does, because anything it can do is still okay. That's the static approach. Of course, that doesn't account for privileged programs, and we need to be able to do that. I think that's sort of an interesting part of the work from a science and research perspective. Some of those programs, by the way, they don't have to be very big. I mean, things like the constructor are well within the complexity threshold that we do know how to verify. They're small. Casebank might be another case because the data structure it manages is pretty big. Okay, so I think that's roughly the end of my list off the top. Anybody have questions? I will send out mail with this, but anybody have questions about this since we're here? Okay, yeah.
Well, I'm going to host another.
Are you willing to? Well, hypothetically, sure. Yes, I need to look at my calendar. It's Monday. We have 5 billion contractors showing up. And offhand, I think I could do the Thursday night thing, but I really need to check. I actually think that this program is much simpler than you did before. Partly because there's nothing here that has to manage multiple endpoints. I mean, this one has to hold several endpoints and call them, but none of the server programs in this story. Other questions? Oh, God. There are review forms sitting in my bag. I should play nice, go down and get them and ask you guys. I always forget about them, so let me go get that.